Dublin.
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film and television. I'm your host, Chandler Poling. On the program today, I have Cameron Moody, composer of the new Hulu series Washington Black, and James Everingham, co-composer of the Apple TV series Chief of War. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Pleasure, pleasure. Now, you're both relatively new to the scene. James, I know you've had credits dating back to your first short film in 2012, but I'm curious, let's starting with you, how have you navigated your career from scoring short films to major network TV shows?
Wow, yeah. I mean, I think the thing that has helped me the most over all the years has been consistently writing. You know, I've been lucky to work on such a huge variety of projects in different mediums. You know, animation, you mentioned short film, obviously Chief of War is sort of long form television, feature films, but also, you know, I've done a lot of natural history scoring as well, which is so music heavy. I think that range of genre and project has really helped strengthen my skills in various different departments. So that when something comes up and there's a need for a specific kind of music or there's a specific kind of scene, I feel like I've got that skill set ready to go, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And Cameron, I was reading that you're the youngest person to ever score a 20th century television series. Congrats on that, by the way. So similar question, where did you start as a composer and how did you get to where you are now?
Well, in terms of going all the way back to when I was a child, you know, I probably have a similar story to a lot of other people in that when I saw Star Wars for the first time, that kind of set me on the course. I mean, I was in love with those films and that music, and it was all that I ever wanted to do was try to replicate that feeling for myself. So I, you know, eventually started playing instruments and studying and really taking a serious approach into learning the craft of writing music. But as far as my film work is concerned, you know, when I was a freshman at NYU, I essentially was plucked out by Michael Abels. He came and spoke at a series of events that they have called Fridays at One, where they'll invite a composer or someone from the business to come and talk to the screen scoring students. And sometimes they'll bring a clip from something that they've scored and they'll let the students write their own cues for them. And so the week that Michael came, he brought two clips from Get Out, and I did one of them. It was the scene, spoiler alert, the scene where Chris finds those photos in that little crawl space right before the big twist towards the end of the third act of the film. But everybody else kind of jumped at the teacup sunken place scene. That's the most famous scene in the film. And I figured at the very least, it would just kind of break up the monotony of seeing so many of those, and it would increase my chances of getting in front of him. So I wrote that cue, it was maybe 90 seconds, and he got to it and liked it and gave some notes. And so after that meeting, I just wrote him a Facebook message and said, thanks for coming. You know, you didn't have to do that. We appreciate it. And he asked for a reel after that. And I sent him something and thinking, you know, this is probably as far as it'll go. And then a week and a half or 2 weeks later, I see an email from him and he's basically like, great, you know, when can you start? And that was, I mean, it's the Hollywood lore, the famous words that you want to hear about, you know, kind of catching a break. But I ended up working for him for 3 years. I left school and kind of joined this school of the more practical, education of actually working for a composer. And it was the most beneficial experience that I could have had. I mean, his star was very much on a kind of alpine trajectory at that time. And so with that came a lot of different things to keep track of, not only musically, but in terms of how he ran his business. And that for someone, at 18, 19, 20 at the time, to have that firsthand experience and to be able to see how it runs, when it came time for me to do it for myself, I felt very well equipped to be able to handle all of that. So I like to think of it as kind of stepping stones. Everything was a very natural progression. And then eventually, after the end of, or the beginning of last year, I made the decision to go ahead and launch, just because, the industry as a whole was kind of still feeling the effects of the strikes. And there was really not a whole lot to be done across the board. And so it felt like the perfect opportunity to go ahead and get my ducks in a row. And, that was a process, and it was scary and all of the kind of associated anxieties that come with that. But thankfully, it only took me a few months to find my footing. And ultimately, that's, kind of what led me to Washington Black. So it was all very, very natural for me, I think.
Fantastic. Now, your musical histories vary between self-taught and classical training. So I'm curious, what are the benefits you feel to your upbringing and how does it apply to your work? And we can start with James.
Yeah, I mean, I never wanted to be a composer, strangely. Unlike Cameron, I never had that moment of watching Star Wars and being like, that's what I want to do. For me, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be the person behind the camera. And I had always been musical and grew up in a musical family, and so I had a lot of exposure to music as a child. But I quickly found that in order to make films, you need to have a lot of friends that need to be willing to partake. And actually, it's a miracle films get made, because it's such a humongous, political process, that being that person behind the camera maybe wasn't the glamorous position that I had always envisaged it to be. And I found that film music was the perfect kind of intersection of my love for film and my love for music. So that was a very natural discovery for me. And I had grown up, playing the piano and the drums by ear. I had always been very, very difficult for my parents to get in, any kind of formal music training. I think we must have been through, at least a dozen music teachers that all sort of tore their hair out and said, not doing it. So, for me, my career so far has been a very natural process of discovery. A lot of, yeah, I mean, I think, by in most senses, self-taught. Even just down to getting to grips in music software was something that, I was lucky to be exposed to at the high school I went to. And, they had, Macs available with Logic and GarageBand, and that was just a discovery that I made in my own time. There's definitely pros and cons that I'm aware of to that process. As a self-taught piano player, I think I gravitate towards chords and a way of, processing music that is maybe less, should we say, like orchestral in nature. And a lot of orchestral writing have a lot of counterpoint and a lot of moving lines, and it's, as a self-taught pianist, it doesn't necessarily fall as naturally on the hands to sort of move around and explore all the different colors in that way. So that's been something that I've worked hard at, and something that I think I've developed in a lot over the years, is breaking out of those instincts as a 5-year-old sitting down at the piano, where do my hands go, and trying to think bigger picture about how do I write for an orchestra, how do I write for singers, how do I write for Hawaiian instrumentalists, right? Like, that's such a different ball game. But at the same time, it's been very freeing, to know that where I am in my career and the music that I'm proud of that I have written has actually all been very, very instinctual and very, from the heart. And music is subjective, right? So to know that it's just very explicitly me, I suppose you could say that's reassuring.
Wonderful. What about you, Cameron? How has your musical upbringing benefited your writing?
I really liked what James, what you said about instincts, because I think that's it resonated with me because that's kind of how I felt about it. I mean, seeing Star Wars as a child, I think had I seen, Pirates of the Caribbean or something of a different kind of musical character, maybe that would have led me ultimately to a different direction. But it was really about that feeling that you get, and it just so happened that it was a 90-piece orchestra that got me there, So what was cool for me was taking Star Wars, to just use the example, and trying to trace its lineage, right? So I would go deeper into the kind of classical symphonic canon of where did John Williams get that? Where did these ideas come from? Who were his people that he looked to as, his kind of North Star? And it was something that over time, you just kind of start to build that vocabulary. And it was natural. Like you said, James, I mean, it was just kind of like, this is what I like. This is how I feel. I feel good when I have my head in a score or when I'm, trying to write something of my own or something like that. And then also, I think it pays to be serviceable as a musician in the sense of playing an instrument. I mean, I'm, certainly not a virtuosic piano player by any stretch of imagination, but I think learning it was important because you have essentially the orchestra at your fingertips. If you can hear it, if you can kind of look at where you are on the keyboard and understand what those colors are, it opens up a lot, and so I would say that, my kind of growth, if you will, has to do with the other side of things, because the orchestra is very much a medium in which I'm very comfortable, and to have had this project be kind of the one I can hang my hat on as the first one, be the style that I grew up idolizing and that I wanted to write was perfect. And then it's also, there's so many more kind of sonic possibilities, right? There's the heavy electronics, there's some of the world instruments and things like that. So for me, it's been, really honing in on the orchestra and getting, for lack of a better word, my chops to a place where I'm comfortable and that I feel like I, can still be original and kind of go different places. But then it's also, this other side of the musical world, especially in film and TV, where it's very electronic, a lot of times, and trying to get more comfortable in those mediums. So it's all been, I guess, if I could sum it up, just instinct. You know what I mean? And so I think that when you said that, it was like, this guy gets it. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how it feels. I mean, it's not anything forced. It's not an affectation. It's just kind of like, I do what I want to hear, and
Absolutely.
that's kind of how I've always done it.
Is there a style or genre or approach to music that you wish you were better at or that you're trying to better yourself in?
Yes. I definitely don't, for one reason or another, utilize electronics very often. I have and I can, but it's not a muscle that is very developed for me, just because I guess through reputation or just dumb luck, I've always kind of been called upon for symphonic music. I mean, even in my days as an assistant, Michael, I think he picked his spots. He knew what I was, I guess, best at, you could say. And so I wasn't really doing things that were too outside of that. And, in one sense, I think it was good. It's definitely beneficial to build those muscles and to kind of have that experience. And at the same time, I think that there's plenty of time to learn this new world. I mean, I look at people like, if you go back a little bit, like Jerry Goldsmith, right? He was one of the very early champions of electronics, and it didn't at all compromise his, earlier works, the Star Treks and the Poltergeist and all that stuff. But incorporating electronics was something that he welcomed, and so I definitely, in this phase of my life and my career, where I'm still very much malleable in the sense of, the kind of projects that I'll take on and things like that, I definitely don't want to close myself off to, well, I'll only write I'll only do a film if they want a symphonic score. I'll only do a show if they want, if they have a 70-piece orchestra or whatever. So electronics are definitely a world in which I'm very excited and something that I welcome kind of adding into my toolbox.
Lots to explore there too. What about you, James?
Whole lot.
For me, it's darkness. It's a genre, horror that is so full of cliches. Cameron, obviously, Michael Abels has done such an incredible job avoiding those cliches and writing such powerful scores that underpin the darker side. So I think I would relish the opportunity to figure out what I would write for something really dark that doesn't fit in that horror box. I think there's some incredible scores out there, just off the top of my head, the Ari Aster movies, right, with Colin Stetson and with Bobby Kotick, like just scores that are maybe a bit more subversive in nature, but yet can underpin something so twisted and so dark, I think would be something, a challenge that I would really enjoy.
Cool. At the top of the show, I played the main theme to Chief of War. And I'd like to talk about that in a little bit, but next I want to hear a piece from Washington Black. So I'm going to play the track titled Wash Flies. Cameron, talk to me about the direction you were given for Washington Black. What sort of notes were you meant to follow when scoring the series?
My earliest conversation with our showrunner, Kim Harrison, she told me two things. Number one, we wanted to avoid music that felt like it was underscoring anything having to do with slavery or the kind of dark, brutal, barbaric world that the character of Wash was born into. We didn't want it to feel heavy and dark in that way, for lack of a better word. We wanted to kind of play to the adventure and the wonder of the character of the show, because that's really what it's about. This is a show about a boy dreaming and, fighting against the constraints that were placed on him and being able to live as the truest version of himself and to have all of the experiences, all of the fantastical things that we dream of as children. And so she made it a point to be very clear about that. But then the second thing was that it had to be big, because the novel takes us all over the world, from the Arctic to America to Nova Scotia to Africa. We needed the score to feel in line with that without rooting us down geographically. We didn't want it to be African instruments when we're in Africa, and brazenly patriotic music for America and some sort of amalgam for any of the other places. So we opted to take a more general emotional approach. And the one of the things that the producers told me when we first started was that they wanted this to be their ET, which I mean is only one of the greatest scores ever written. So there's absolutely no pressure at all, right? But it was less about the theme being similar or anything like that, and more about the vocabulary for one, but also the feeling emotionally that you get. We wanted to be emotionally connected to these characters, to their arcs. We wanted the stakes to feel real, and we wanted to root for our main characters, because they're our heroes. They're the people that we want to see do good, and we want to see them win. And if we have an Elliot flying over the moon sequence, then great. You know what I mean? But it was really about communicating the emotion of Wash, because we are in his perspective for the entire series, be it as the young boy or as the adult. So we wanted as much of the score to feel like we're approaching it from his perspective, and how he would be interacting with these characters, and how he would be relating to this world. And then it had to be big. We had to kind of go all out. And it became very clear that the kind of emotional depth that this score required extended beyond the limitations of synthesizers, actually. So it would have felt inappropriate, I think, for the world if we had introduced some electronics and anything like that. So they very much wanted to keep it acoustic and keep it natural. And so for me, that was, the perfect opportunity, I think, especially for a television series, because that's not really a brief that you get very often. So the opportunity to take a big swing at something symphonic and traditional, for lack of a better word, that was something that it was like a kid at a candy store. I mean, when you get the call for something like that, especially given how attached I was to, the ETs of the world and all of these other scores, it was, I mean, I'm still pinching myself even now that that's something that I got to do out of the gate.
Cool. Yeah, James, I'm going to hit you with the same question, but before we do, we're going to listen to a track from Chief of War. This is a piece called Stand with Maui. So, James, where did the showrunner lead you when it comes to scoring this series? And how did you and Hans Zimmer collaborate on the music?
Yeah, I mean, look, Chief of War, Jason Momoa and Pa'a Sibert, they've been developing this show for what, 10 years or so, but the show has really been in development for 200 years when you think about it.
Right.
A lot of these themes of identity and belonging and culturally significant, this is what Chief of War is about. It's about learning from the past and moving forwards with a kind of newfound wisdom. And it's just a huge moment for Hawaiian storytelling and representation. So, the moment we had that first call, it was pretty obvious that the Hawaiian collaborations were going to be a huge factor in the score. This show is really a celebration of Hawaii. It's Hawaiian directed, it's Hawaiian produced. There's overwhelmingly Polynesian cast. I have major imposter syndrome as a white guy from England. So it was very obvious to us that the Hawaiian element and getting that part right and doing it authentically and respectfully was going to be the key to a successful score. And I don't know if I really appreciated what I had coming. I wasn't really aware of what I'd signed up for. That initial research, it became very clear that I knew basically nothing about ancient Hawaii. I think you think Hawaii, you think, oh, ukulele, no, that's not what we're doing here. So thankfully, Jason had already thought about that in hiring Hans and I. And he brought out Komeka Iwa Kanakaole. And she had been a huge part of production, as a consultant on set. But also, she's got an incredible story as well. Her great grandma is Edith Kanakaole, who was a seminal figure of the Hawaiian Renaissance. She really was central to bringing Hawaiian culture back to the islands. And Kamakaiva Iwa has really dedicated her life to, preserving that legacy through her own, musical career. So she was a big part of making that happen, of making that Hawaiian element feel correct and feel appropriate. And for me, then my job became, alongside Hans, how can we take that traditional Hawaiian element and bring that into the world of cinema, the world of television? And we've got 9 hours of TV to score, and it's such a wide range of material, right? You've got everything that takes place on Hawaii. But Kaiana, the protagonist, he also travels to Zamboanga, and he's in the mountains of Alaska. And so there's so much to cover there. You've got the story of the colonials and how they came to the islands. So there was a great breadth there. And, for me, the real pleasure was being that vessel to take the traditional Hawaiian stuff and give it a new voice. I early on in the process, I'm going on YouTube and I'm searching for traditional Hawaiian musical performances, and there's just not that much out there. So it was a exciting opportunity, I think, to take, some of the most incredible Hawaiian performers and give them this platform. We listened to the main title earlier. I mean, much of Chief of War is in Ōlelo Hawaii, the Hawaiian language. And it's not just a huge moment for, young people hearing that and being inspired and connecting with their ancestry, but also for older generations that have never seen a film or television show in their own language, in their native tongue. And we wanted to carry that through to the score as well. The main title opens in Hawaiian, Leina Nui Lehua Lei Kau Leha Ena. That means from beginning to end, from first light to last. To start a main title in Valhalla Hawaii, that's never been done before. So that was a really exciting opportunity. And Hans is such, he's just the goat when it comes to, taking those elements and bringing them in and creating this sort of world of, cinematic music that is maybe influenced by, musical genres or artists that haven't been in that space before.
The main title is gorgeous, and I'm so glad that we got to play it at the top of the show. Yeah, I loved hearing the language in it, and you make a interesting point that it's a very unique opportunity to utilize one of these older languages in a main title on American television. So that must have been exciting to do. So when you're working in that language, obviously there must be some sort of linguist or somebody that's helping you verify that everything is done correctly. How was there a consultant or anybody in that regard?
That was Kamaka Eva Kanaka Ole. Yeah, she not only did she sing on the score and advise them on in production on set as well, but we spent so much time together hashing out what the lyrics were going to be. A lot of it was long distance, with like FaceTiming, and because she was she's got a busy tour schedule, she's going around the world. She was in Japan when we first started, and I'm trying to catch her like in between shows and ask her like what can we do for this scene. So she was really the key to that, and she came to my studio in LA, and we sat down for a number of days and just looked at the scenes and said, what do we need here? Where do we want to go more heavy on the lyrics? Where do we want to back off and maybe just do something a bit more atmospheric? Yeah, and for her as a character, like she's so funny and so crazy. I know she wouldn't mind me saying that it completely broke down any barrier of, is this appropriate? Is this, I have to feel completely comfortable asking her, what can we do this? Is this rude? Like, is this appropriate? Is this authentic? Like, and she would not hesitate to say to me, oh yeah, don't do that. Like, that's gonna offend some people. Or no, what do you mean? Like, no, that's beautiful. Let's do that. And there were moments where it made sense. I think we're gonna listen to one later where Kamaka Eva could lead, right? And she could present a chant in Hawaiian that we could then base the score around. And there were moments where it made sense to take something that Hans and I had written and have her be featured on that. So we kind of approached it from both angles. But the big thing really that stuck with me over that whole process was Kamaka Eva told me early on, culture is not a condiment, right? It's not something that you sprinkle on at the end as like the little finishing touches. For me, I always had in mind that the score for Chief of War had to be rooted in traditional Hawaiian music. It's got to be grounded in that. If ever I lose sight of what this score is supposed to be, I got to come back to that. I'm not going to listen to my film score influences. I'm going to watch Hawaiian hula performances, and that's my entry point into the scenes wherever possible.
Excellent. We talked about your main title, but Cameron, you also wrote a main title for Washington Black. Before we talk about it, let's listen to it. So I'm going to play the main title theme from Washington Black. So, Cameron, how does a main title theme come to be, and how many iterations are needed to find the perfect tone?
So it's interesting, Chandler. I have a confession to make. I only wrote one version of the title sequence, and that is which we just heard.
That's very
And I
lucky.
also, it is, but I also did it at the very end. It was the very last thing that I wrote, maybe a week before our last recording day. And the reason for that was, besides what can be common in deciding if we're going to do the main title at the beginning or if we're going to have it in the credits at the end and the kind of confusion about where it's going to go, I wanted to make sure that I had enough material that if I wanted to draw from a specific theme or something in the show, that I wasn't being too preemptive in writing a main title sequence that felt too distant from the material from the series. And it actually came to pass that the title sequence that we hear is the theme for Wash. And when I did episode one, I wasn't really sure thematically how I was going to represent this character. And one of the big challenges was we meet him in the beginning of episode one as an adult or as a, late teens. But then we immediately go back in time almost a decade, and he's a child. And it's the same character, but we have to find something musically that we can mature as he gets older and still feel like the same character. And it was really, really difficult to try to crack that. And so initially, what became Wash's theme only really represented moments of scientific discovery for him. But over the course, really, of the first two episodes, I found that there were a lot of those moments. And so it felt appropriate to that we could kind of merge the two ideas that Wash and the love for science, the discovery, the fantasy, and the adventure, and all of those kinds of scenarios are kind of one and the same. And so, to bridge that gap and to make them uniform and to make Wash essentially represented by this short sequence of notes felt appropriate. And thankfully, everyone, our showrunner and everybody responded to that. And so it was great because the melody that we hear is open-ended. It's not necessarily a closed bracket, beginning, middle, end statement. And that was good because it allowed for a lot of versatility and flexibility with how we play it, not only in terms of instrumentation, whether we play it with the whole orchestra or with one instrument, but we can treat it according to the situation. So in some cases we play it very fast all at once. In some cases we play just the first little bit of the phrase, or we play it on a solo instrument or something like that. And it allowed us to kind of break it apart and treat it according to the situation. And so for the main title, it felt like the first time that we have an unabridged minute to be able to just play it without, messing with it, or kind of ducking down below dialogue. But it also is in a, I guess, a weird way, a representation of the show, in the sense that we start out presenting the melody in a way that's almost a little childlike. It's in the woodwinds, it's very jaunty and kind of, it has a lot of bounce. And then over the course of the piece, we have the bold statement and the strings and the brass that kind of grows as the character grows into a more full-bodied statement. And then we're able to bring it back down at the very end to a more kind of firm resolution, while also leaving the door open, if you will, because even at the conclusion of the final episode, Wash's story is not over, presumably. It's not, something that is finished. So we can imagine and kind of guess where this character goes. And so musically, I wanted to be able to represent that. And I hope that I was successful in doing that.
Yeah, it's interesting the concept of waiting till the very end. I feel like that obviously is wise because the main title, there's a lot of weight on that. You've got a repetitive thing that you play at the top of every episode, and it sets the, audio signature of the show that everyone's about to watch. Or if they're in the middle of watching it, it has to make them feel like they're jumping back in if they're not binging it, if they're waiting, a week or two in between episodes. So that's amazing that you just did it in a one shot. So congratulations. What about you, James? I know we talked a little bit about your main title, but was there a lot of finessing to it? Was it right out the gate what you wanted? What was it?
It's funny, like Cameron, I had a completely parallel experience. Maybe it wasn't the sort of like hole in one in the same way, but I also did the main title at the very end, and we just listened to the main title and Stand With Maui. Stand With Maui was one of the very first things we wrote. In fact, maybe the first thing we wrote, back in early 2023. And it was all about discovering what Kayana's theme was, Jason's character. And Cameron, very similarly to what you said, it what began as the theme for Kayana discovering the prophecy and all these themes of the show, it evolves into his th personal theme,
Right.
and which by the time we've grown with these characters, became very clear it's actually the main theme in many ways. And so, for me, that was a wonderful bookend to the scoring process to start with Stand With Maui, discover this character, go through all 9 hours worth of television, and then at the very end, come back and go, this is the identity of the show. This is what comes at the very front of every episode. A very similar experience getting to state that theme properly at the beginning of the show is just, then when you get those little hints at it throughout the episodes, it all makes, a lot more sense. And as well with our Hawaiian collaborators, it felt like the main title in many ways was the sort of greatest hits, I guess, from what we were able to capture with everyone, from Kamakaiva, with the incredible vocal groups that she assembled on Oahu and in Los Angeles. They all have their moment on the main title. And the incredible members of the Poe and the Forefathers group that we got to work with. Kawai Ho on the Hawaiian nose flute has his little moment there in the main title. And that was what it was all about, really, is you have the main title graphic is the sort of beauty of Hawaii, and then it kind of devolves into death and war, and that's kind of the story of the show in a way. It's like this island that we call home, how that's threatened by the wars, not only between the Hawaiian chiefs, but also, the threat that the colonials bring. We got to sort of reflect that in the main title. So you open with the Hawaiian voices, the Hawaiian notes, so you're very grounded in that. And then as it continues, you get more orchestra, more traditional elements, Western elements, incredible orchestra that we recorded at Synchron Stage in Vienna for the main title. Yeah, felt like a wonderful full circle moment actually to come back and do that at the end.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Well, before we get to the end of the show, I wanted to play one more track from Chief of War. This is the track titled Pauiki Pau Nui. James, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Can you just tell us why did you choose that particular track to play for the show?
I think it's a, it's such a bold musical moment, and you hear the blow of the poo, the conch shell, towards the end there, and that's such a iconic, instrument of traditional, Hawaiian culture. We spent a great deal of time discussing with Pa'a, the exec and the creator of the show, Doug, the showrunner, and Kiawe, who was one of the language consultants, about where we wanted to have sort of overtly traditional Hawaiian voices and oles. There were moments where, like I said earlier, it made sense for it to be more atmospheric, and there were moments where it made sense for it to be more at the forefront of the music, like it is in this moment here. Obviously you've got Hawaiian dialogue, so it's a very tough thing to put Hawaiian lyrics over many of these scenes. There were moments where it was obvious to do something that was vocal led like this, and moments where we needed to discuss whether it would impede what was happening on screen, and maybe was it going to evoke a significance that wasn't intended. But this is the scene from the end of episode 5 that we agreed made sense, and for this moment, I gave it to Kamiko Iva, and I said, what would you do here? And she went into the studio on the Big Island with the incredible, actually Grammy-winning producer Charles Brotman, and wrote these lyrics, which is just so perfectly intertwined with what's happening on screen in this moment. And that's her on the pahu drum, which is, one of the main percussion instruments of ancient Hawaii. It's a hollowed out log drum with a shark skin top. So I won't say exactly what she's singing about to avoid any spoilers. But it's almost like an Easter egg for Hawaiian speakers. And instead of the traditional sort of atmospheric vowels that you often get in film music, I think for her to be singing about the specific events that are taking place in history, it really evokes an emotion that I think you can make out. It's just inherently tied to what's happening on the screen. And I was talking earlier about, I guess, being, the vessel that can take something so traditional and elevate it up in American television. This was just such a fun moment to do that, to take something that she had done that she's so comfortable with and just kind of flip it upside down, I guess. And for her as well, it was a fun experience. Whoa, this is not a context that I've ever heard, a traditional Hawaiian performance in before. So this is sort of the other end of the spectrum. It's just a whole lot of fun to do.
Very cool. We're at the end of the show, and I have to ask a question that I ask of all my guests. The question is, what was the first album you purchased, and what was the last thing you listened to? And we'll start with Cameron.
Ooh, that's a good question. The first album I ever purchased was the Thriller album from Michael Jackson.
Oh, yes.
I remember this was back in the days of iTunes when you would, have a song was $1.29 or something like that. And I remember I had saved up, I think the album was like $12 or $13 or something. But I wanted to own it. And I remember saving up my allowance from doing chores, and I bought this album, and I was so happy. And I had a little iPod. You remember the little blue ones that were like that big and you could clip
Yep,
onto
yeah.
yourself? I had one of those, and I loaded it up, and I remember just burning that album. I mean, just so much. And it's still, I think, the one of my top three albums of all time. It stands the test of time. Michael Jackson, we don't have to, I don't have to tell you guys how great he is, but that album and the fact that he was like 24 when he made that album
It's
is
unbelievable.
just it's unfair. Let's see. The last thing I listened to, I can tell you actually. I'm going to go into my. What was the last thing I listened to?
You have to be completely honest.
Oh,
It
I
is
am. I
Sabrina
trust me.
Carpenter, you gotta say.
No, no, I will. I will. The last thing that I listened to. Okay, yeah, sure. So, have either of you ever heard of a guy called Leon Thomas?
Haven't.
He was a child actor in the Disney or in the Nickelodeon world. He did that show Victorious with Victoria Justice and all the, this other thing. But he is he's won a couple of Grammys. He's written songs for Ariana Grande and all these other people. But he has an album called Mutt, like the dog. It is genuinely one of the best R&B albums I think out there. I mean, it's fantastic, and he released the deluxe edition of that album, and it's I mean we're back like we're I think we're back in an era where we have people like him that are writing genuinely good music, and he's a phenomenal singer and instrumental. And so that's the last non-film music album I listened to. I'll give you a film music answer quickly. I really love what Hans did with Formula One. I saw that film a couple times, and was so energized by that, you know, with the score, because of course he has his, you know, trademarked hybrid sound. But then there was a good deal of, you know, some of the hip hop stuff that he incorporated, and the soundtrack album that has all of the needle drops and things. So I really dug Formula One.
Excellent.
Yeah.
James, what about you?
I have to echo that. Formula One was just, I mean, also just an incredible film. Like, you know, we work in the entertainment industry, and like, this is the most entertaining film I've seen for a really long time. Right?
No,
There's no
exactly.
pretense. It's just fun. And such a, you know, it's Hans doing what Hans does best. So for me, yeah, you know, that's been on repeat. Also recently, you know, Eric Clapton, I've been rediscovering just so many incredible melodies. And, you know, there was this movie, Cameron, maybe you know it. It's a Williams score, Space Camp from the
Oh
80s.
yeah, love Space
And
Camp.
it's a movie that was, unfortunately, you know, it didn't really get the recognition it deserved because of the Challenger disaster that I think happened maybe the same year or shortly afterwards or before release. I don't remember exactly. Long before my time. But there's this Eric Clapton song, Forever Man, that blasts out of the car as one of the main characters drives up at the start. And it's just such an incredible guitar riff. I don't know. You know, it came on the radio recently and I was like, where do I know this from? And you know, it was an iconic piece of music from my childhood, and getting to rediscover it recently and blast it. I don't know. It's just Eric Clapton, can't go wrong.
Beautiful. Well, guys, I want to thank you so much for being on the program, Studio Soundtracks only on Dublab Radio. Listeners can find soundtracks to your work on streaming platforms of choice. And I hope everybody goes out and watches Washington Black and Chief of War, Washington Black being on Hulu as a reminder, and Chief of War on Apple TV. I'm going to have some outro music that is going to be the piece titled Finale from Washington Black by Cameron. And once again, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thank you for having
Thank you
us.
for having us. This was great.